Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The Swag Watch is on. If Washington has moved to Denver for the week, so have the lobbyists and the corporate interests. So as we'll be doing all this week and next, let's follow the money trail, taking a look at the sponsors who are everywhere here at the convention and try to figure out exactly what they're looking for from government. We are partnering for this with the folks at the Center for Responsive Politics at OpenSecrets.org, and joining us now is the Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics, Sheila Krumholtz. Sheila, welcome to WNYC. Thanks for coming by our Radio Row booth here at the Democratic Convention.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So before we start, or let's start by, actually, let's see, where'd that swag bag go? We had a bag here. This is the bag. Somewhere. There it is. This is the tote bag. Like, you know, the public radio tote bags, folks. They give out this big black canvas tote bag. So at least it's a canvas tote bag. It's the kind of thing that you can bring to go shopping with you and avoid the plastic bags. When you see this bag, the first thing that you notice, if you're looking at one side, is Coca-Cola.
Right.
And the if you're looking at the other side, the first thing you notice is AT&T with its logo really big, much bigger than where it says Denver 2008 on that side of the bag. On the other side, the Coca-Cola logo is about the same size as the DNCC08 logo. And so let's dip in here. Now, I wrote about this in our Twitter feed yesterday, the sponsorship on the outside of the bag. And then now we're going to go through some of the stuff in the bag here. Let's see. There is a water bottle from Visa.
Thank you very much, Visa.
Nice big water bottle.
And U.S. Bank.
There's, let's see, what's Escape Hybrid? There's an Escape Hybrid keychain. And let's see, we also have an American Wind Energy Association pin of some kind and something called Joint Juice. So, all right, let's start on the outside, Sheila. Coca-Cola. Now, I guess it's kind of obvious. We're here at the Pepsi Center.
Right.
That's where the convention is being held, the Pepsi Center. So Coca-Cola maybe just wants to get its marketing equal time to the delegates for soda sales. But do Coke and Pepsi have any policy agenda with the government?
Oh, undoubtedly they do. They have virtually any company of their size, a multinational company, is going to have regulatory issues about food safety, about taxation, trade. There are always going to be some pretty significant issues on the docket at any given time.
So let's look specifically. How about AT&T, which has the big logo on the outside of this bag? What are they looking for from government right now?
Well, I was going to say right now, with this promotional material, they are looking to compete with Quest, which is wiring the convention. So AT&T is here to kind of also have a big presence.
Right, and I didn't even mention that when they give out these lanyards that you wear around your neck, if you've ever been to a convention, folks, or anything that requires a high degree of security, you often get credentials or ID cards, not just to carry with you, but to wear. And so to facilitate that they give out these lanyards that you wear around your neck, and they are Quest lanyards in this case. So it says about, I don't know, 15 times along the length of this thing, Quest DNCC 2008. And it makes it look like, as you look at this little gifty here, it makes it look like Quest and the Democratic National Committee are one and the same.
Right, brought to you by Quest. And in fact, in a way, that's true. They're sponsoring parties. They're providing in-kind and direct contributions. So the event is, in fact, brought to us by Quest and AT&T and these others.
Let's see, which was the company that refused to go along with the FISA telecom I guess this is not your area, but I think it might have been Quest that said, no, we won't do that kind of data collection.
I think that's right. And that's, for AT&T, for all telecom, that is a big concern.
So
because
we'll
that's still coming next year.
That's right. And we'll see next week if Quest is also sponsoring at the Republican convention after having done that. But what did you say? What's coming next year?
Well, with the FISA issue, they, of course, were looking for retroactive immunity on warrantless wiretapping, and they got a reprieve this year, but my understanding is that the investigation will still be hanging over their heads for next year. So nothing is, nothing is guaranteed for the future.
Right. And what about Visa? Why is Visa, let's see, it actually says Visa U.S. Bank. I don't know U.S. Bank. Is that a major?
They are a major company, and they are both, of course, significant financial industry donors at the federal level to candidates and parties. And, of course, here they are sponsoring swag at the convention.
Right,
and
it's a huge water bottle, by the way. I don't think I've – this will not fit in your backpack water container little pouch, right? This is, I don't know, it must be like 32 ounces or something. It's gigantic. It won't, you can't clip it onto your bicycle.
It's symbolic it's symbolic of their largesse here.
Their largesse. But large on it is the logo for Visa. So what would a credit card company want right now from the government?
Again, they're going to be very concerned about regulation. In this next year, that is going to be one of the top two or three issues confronting financial companies. Visa, along with any of the financial kind of Wall Street companies that have major involvement with the subprime mortgage collapse, and particularly hedge funds, are all looking at protecting their taxation rates, avoiding any new regulation, and just keeping cordial relations with party leadership, key members of Congress, key committee members who have jurisdiction over their issues.
And, of course, just a few years ago, they got a big bankruptcy bill, which the credit card companies had wanted. It made it harder for individuals in America to declare bankruptcy in a way that gave them protection from their credit card debt. So they won that. And, of course, now that Joe Biden is the nominee for vice president, he comes from Delaware, which is a state that has particularly favorable rules, which is why it seems that a lot of our credit card bills get mailed to Delaware, because that's the state where some of these companies are located.
Yeah, I think there is going to be a hard look taken, at least I hope there will be a hard look taken, at the particularly the kinds of contracts that credit cards make consumers sign, because the fine print now is not one, two, or three pages long. It's pages and pages long, and it is really punitive. Again, this is, yes, there are very powerful interests. The bankruptcy legislation is one key example of that, and they are going to have ample representation in Washington.
And we see again this pin from the American Wind Energy Association, which we might think, gosh, wind power, alternative renewable energy source, that's great. But it's also a business and an industry, and so they're getting their industry's name out there among these people. And a lot of the delegates are, of course, state legislators, members of Congress, other people who have influence at the level of government. Last thing, do you happen to know how these sorts of sponsorship deals get brokered? I mean, it's one thing if they're buying commercials on a television network or that kind of sponsorship, but to broker these sponsorship deals with a political party.
Right. Somehow it's saying that this is a PR opportunity that they don't want to miss. Others are saying that this is extortion. They don't have the potential. They don't really have the ability to say no, particularly if they have issues that they're concerned about upcoming in the next Congress. You don't want to say no to the wrong person now at this time and expect to get doors open to you when you want to plead your case in Washington.
Sheila Krumholz, Executive Director for the Center for Responsive Politics. See their stuff relevant to this at opensecrets.org, and we'll continue this series during the week as we see more of the swag on our swag watch here at the DNC. Thanks a lot for coming on.
My pleasure.
And by the way, Bob Henley, who's been covering protests here in Denver, has pointed out that the protesters can't get close to the arena, but lots of corporate sponsors can. And we're going to talk to Bob Henley about the streets in a minute. WNYC, and joining me now to talk about various things going on here in Denver is WNYC's Bob Henley. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
Now, one of the things that you've been doing is covering the protests. There haven't been that many protests yet. I did wake up to a Denver radio station this morning talking about the most intense yet somewhere last night. But what's the scene? Give us the big picture. I mean, when we covered the conventions in 2004, both in Boston and the Republican convention in New York, the protests were such an integral part of the story.
What's happening here, of course, is that we were inside the Pepsi Center. I was last night. And to give people a sense of how remote that is, you have to cross over a moat of rushing water and then go on foot for like what feels like 3/4 of a mile to get to the area to think about getting into the place where you might do your work. The protesters are very far away. In fact, the event last night, which indeed we've been able to confirm independently that 100 and some odd people were arrested. The police did use pepper spray. It happened at Civic Center Park, roughly a mile from the convention center. And what emerges here is something we've seen, you know, even back in the RNC in 2004, which is two competing narratives which have nothing in common with each other except that they are alleged to have happened on the same day. The police version is that around 7 p.m. last night, police were confronted by a group of 300 protesters, some of whom were allegedly carrying rocks. Police contend the group was obstructing pedestrian traffic, and they gave orders for the crowd to disperse, and they did not. They also allege some protesters rushed the police line. And the protesters were held in charge with obstructing streets, interference with police, and disobeying a lawful order. Now, Eyewitness Video, which is a group that works with the National Lawyers Guild, you may know Eileen Clancy. They've done a lot of work with the RNC and documenting police behavior at these kinds of events. They have a totally different story, Brian. They say the police were the aggressors at a protest event that was calm and starting to ebb. They say the police never gave an order to disperse and continued to advance until they got close to protesters. And that the police then tried to divide them into smaller groups at a point which the group, or at least some of them, sat down and were asking, you know, chanting to be let go. So it's hard to reconcile this, especially when the focus is on the big show. So ironically, you have Trojan condoms that has no trouble having access to the convention. Indeed, they have a little kiosk there where they hand out condoms on the way in. UPS has access.
Oh, I haven't seen that one yet.
Oh, absolutely.
What exactly do they think is going to happen in here?
I have no idea, but the point here is that what we have in the first part of the 21st century is free speech is commercial speech that's paid for.
Right. Now, you were on the floor last night here at the Pepsi Center, and one of the things that you're doing in addition to covering the protests is covering the New Jersey delegation. Are state politics being played out here behind the scenes in addition to national politics?
Well, absolutely. As you know, for many congressional hopefuls, the road to Washington is making a wild departure detour through Denver. So you'll have the candidate, Rabbi Shulman, from the 5th Congressional District from Demarest. He's a psychologist. He's blind. He's got an amazing life story. He's running against Republican Scott Garrett, an incumbent who is often on your show. That is turning out to be more of a race than anyone expected. It was essential for Rabbi Shulman to be here in Denver raising money and raising his profile. Similarly, now you have Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney told me that she thinks as many as 4 Democratic contenders have a chance of carrying Republican districts. So it's all about that. That's so true. You know, we have the state Senate race in New York State. It is about the local dynamic. It's about town hall, city hall, and the state house.
Election for Albany. We talked to Sheldon Silver yesterday. We talked to a bunch of people when we broadcast from outside the New York delegation's breakfast. So now we're hearing New York and New Jersey behind-the-scenes politics going on here at the state level, even as it's the national convention in Denver. Give us a quick preview of the podium tonight. Of course, we played speech excerpts earlier today from Michelle Obama and from Ted Kennedy. Tonight, Hillary Clinton and who else?
Well, of course, Governor Patterson, and of course for New Jersey partisans, Democrats, is, you know, they're a little depressed because there is, for a long time in recent memory, there is no New Jersey representative up in the podium. And so that is being seen as, you know, an opportunity. There is an effort now, if you will, to draft Senator Robert Menendez to be the person that gets to represent New Jersey. Now, here's where it gets interesting. He was a big Hillary Clinton supporter. He has also very high visibility in the Latino community across the country. In fact, when he won the U.S. Senate seat, it made headlines in Florida, where the Cuban-American community, as you know, have long been electoral kingmakers. So there's a behind-the-scenes effort here, with even some support of Obama New Jersey partisans, to try to get Menendez up there on the stage, because that would be really a practical sign that this is a healed party moving forward together.
WNYC's Bob Henley out and about here in Denver. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And if this convention is an infomercial, the ultimate goal is to make some sales, right? And how do you track these sales? Well, through polling, of course, but as we all know, it's not that simple. So let's bring in one of our favorite poll watchers, Nate Silver, the man behind 538.com. He's here in Denver blogging, and I think we woke him up this morning far earlier than he wanted to be up. It's only about 9:22 in the morning here, Denver time. So, Nate, thanks a lot for waking up early and catching the shuttle bus to the Pepsi Center.
I wish it were that easy, Brian. A few security perimeters to navigate, but we're all good now.
That's right. Well, as Bob was describing, this is for the people like us who are actually allowed to be here. You take a shuttle bus to somewhere, and then you walk what Bob said feels like 3/4 of a mile, and then you wait in line, and then you go through one security checkpoint and another security checkpoint. It was like this in 2004 as well, but it's serious business just trying to get into the Democratic National Convention.
Oh, but they have to be careful, too.
Of course.
I mean, I understand every part of it, but it's not quite catch a cab and get down to the Pepsi Center.
Bounce out of bed and into work right here. That's right. And for people who don't know your work, 538.com is a site that watches various pollsters and kind of comments on how the polling is being done, as well as kind of aggregating a lot of different polls and trying to take out some bits of wisdom and some facts from a whole large number of different organizations' polls, even though some of the individual ones may not be done that well, and along the line critiquing the process of polling and how it is done and kind of rating good polls and bad polls. And 538 is the number of total electoral votes in the presidential election. That's where your web address comes from, 538.com.
Correct.
Let's start with a post that you did on your blog called "Can Biden Out Hillary Hillary?" What'd you write?
Well, we were looking at where Biden has strong favorability ratings with, and it really is mostly among Democrats. So it is a case of not appealing to Republicans. I think he's kind of a, you know, Washington blowhard. Independent voters like him reasonably well, but really it's Democrats. Everyone kind of agrees that Joe Biden is an acceptable choice. So he might be the candidate to do what Hillary was supposed to do, which is kind of get the Democratic vote behind Barack Obama. If he gets that vote, because Democrats outnumber Republicans by about 8 or 10 points now, it's pretty hard for McCain to win.
I guess the question with that, though, is, and I don't know how you measure this in a poll, will Biden actually elevate the passion among the potential Democratic electorate to turn out in the way that Hillary Clinton would have? You know, because she's got such diehard supporters. We saw it in the primaries. He doesn't, which we also saw it in the primaries. So people may have a favorable impression of Joe Biden in general, but it just, you know, strikes me at the gut level that there are a lot more people who are going to say, wow, Hillary's on the ticket, now I'm going to go out and vote, than are going to say, wow, Joe Biden might be my next vice president, and turn out to the polls on that basis.
Yeah, I mean, enthusiasm is more difficult to measure. I mean, I think among voters who are 18 to 29, they're going to turn out for Obama no matter what. I think older voters might like Joe Biden, meaning even the kind of 60, 65 and older, but maybe some of those kind of, you know, baby boomer kind of 55-year-old female voters especially, you know, are not going to be as motivated to go to the polls by anyone except Hillary Clinton.
And there's also the enthusiasm gap with respect to Obama and McCain. They may be running pretty close in the total number or percentage of Americans who say they're leaning toward one or the other. But when you ask, are you strongly enthusiastic about your candidate, there's a huge enthusiasm gap, with Obama supporters being much more enthusiastic than McCain supporters, correct?
Right, and McCain has gained some ground here, and even with that, though, Obama is the most kind of strong, favorable candidate. The people who like him as much as any candidate since Reagan in 84. So that's, you know, pretty unprecedented, really. But it'd be even higher if you had the Hillary supporters behind him, amazingly.
And does history tell us that that enthusiasm actually does turn into a different turnout? Because, again, and you know, and one of the things that we're going to talk about, I think, to me, the most important thing for us to talk about is what these poll numbers actually mean when they show that they are roughly tied within the statistical margin of error. I have a feeling from things that I've been reading, including your website, that it isn't quite as tied as that top number, 42 for McCain, 42% for Obama, would seem to indicate. But if that's the percentage that tells you that they're leaning for each of these candidates, how does the enthusiasm gap actually reflect itself in November?
Well, we've never had an enthusiasm gap quite this large before, so it's hard to say. But there have been elections, again, going back to Reagan, really, in 1980, where his voters were a lot more enthusiastic than Jimmy Carter's. And he wound up winning that election by 9 or 10 points when the polls had it being a close election, a 2- or 3-point election in either direction. So that would be the most favorable precedent for Obama. But there is an anti-Obama vote, too, and that's what's kind of becoming more enthusiastic, and there's not much of an anti-McCain vote.
Uh-huh. So that's another question that the pollsters would really ask, would have to ask, to get a legitimate read on enthusiasm, right? With Republicans, especially with what you just said, they wouldn't just have to ask, are you very enthusiastic for McCain? They would have to somehow get to, are you very motivated to stop Obama?
Yeah, and that's how some pollsters break it out. They say, is this a pro-McCain vote, if you're voting for McCain, or an anti-Obama vote? And for the McCain voters, about a third of those votes are not McCain votes at all. They're anti-Obama votes, whereas for Obama, 90% are pro-Obama votes.
So when I go to your website, and also when I go to another poll aggregation website, pollster.com, the first thing I see is electoral vote projections. And when you look at that, it's not quite as close as when you look at this national poll that's across state lines, which are seeing, you know, roughly 40% support for each of them, and, you know, maybe 15% undecided or so. You've got now, what is it, a 260 electoral vote projection for Obama, and you only need 270 to win the election. You have a much lower figure for McCain. Break that down for us.
Yeah, well, one advantage Obama has is that he still is playing mostly offense. He really only has to win one of maybe three or four states. If he wins any one of Ohio, Florida, Colorado, and Virginia, any one of those four, and it's very hard for McCain to win. So he's trying to kind of defend four different kind of fronts at once. So that gives Obama a kind of systemic advantage in the Electoral College. He might lose the popular vote by a point and actually win the Electoral College, kind of a reverse of 2000.
Interesting. Should we be reading the polls that we generally hear about with you know, more grains of salt? I mean, I feel like I hear it every day. A new CBS New York Times poll, a new MSNBC poll, a new CNN poll, whatever they are. Reuters Zoghbi was one last week that found that McCain had pulled even with Obama in this big top-line national number. But when we hear it, should we say, well, that's a kind of meaningless number. We should be looking at the, you know, the aggregated electoral vote state-by-state polls if we want to have a number that has any meaning.
Yeah, and there's a lot more data at the state level, too. You might have, you know, seven state polls released every day versus five national polls in a week. So to kind of pick up, you know, really granular changes in momentum, sometimes the state polls will tell you first, be leading indicators.
Right. So are there any state polls that you've been watching that are giving you really interesting information the last few weeks?
Well, some states have gotten tight. Like Colorado was leaning Obama, and that's now more of a toss-up. Florida, which was kind of lean McCain, is now moving closer to toss-up. So Obama's kind of gained ground there, and I think Joe Biden might help in Florida. But until the convention's over, I mean, these next 2 weeks, I would say don't read a poll at all, almost. With both conventions occurring back-to-back, with the VP nominations, with all this kind of stuff going on, it's going to be very hard to tell kind of who has which current of momentum at which time. It's best to kind of shut it out, watch the convention, enjoy the convention, but don't pay too much attention to the polls until mid-September, really.
We certainly saw in the Democratic primaries how demographics seem to be destiny. gender, race, age, class, all of these things. If you figured out where somebody, you know, stood along those various demographic lines, you could almost predict whether they were going to vote for Obama or Clinton. Are we seeing that in the general election, too?
To some extent, but some things have been reversed. Like Obama is doing very now well with Latino voters, which wasn't true in the primaries. He's doing better, not quite as well as he might like, with kind of, you know, working class, no college voters. But, you know, it was almost sharper demographically during the primaries, I think, because people were so similar ideologically. They're all Democrats, and, you know, I think both Hillary and Obama are kind of toward the center of the Democratic Party. You know, now you have ideological differences, so that's more obvious. I mean, the big one you have now is really generational, where Obama is underperforming John Kerry among seniors, and that's really kind of 60 and up, and obviously way overperforming among voters kind of age 35 and under. But that's the main kind of fault line, it seems, now.
I got to play a clip that we found on the Onion's website about this Demographics is Destiny year. Their demographics analysis goes way beyond what the traditional media does. Let's hear how the Onion is breaking it down.
There's also religion, soda preference, drug use, body mass index, number of tattoos, size of television screens, and favorite non-sports pastimes. Oh. Of course, the big news this morning is over the battle over the Dunkin' Donuts independence.
Oh, that's right.
That is, yes, the working class swing voters who make under $60,000 a year. McCain was able to gain 3 points with them just this week.
Wow.
You know, time and time again, if we look back, we have seen how
yes,
they influence the Dinty Moore dads, men with multiple illegitimate children who eat single-serving microwavable meals for dinner.
And this is Obama's weak area right now.
That is right. That, and of course, the Corolla in-laws, what the Democrats are losing there, they're rapidly picking up with dental office receptionists who plan on going back to school to get their real estate degree someday.
And later in that video, we learned that Democrats were also polling strongly with groups like artisanal sandwich eaters. So I guess it begs the question of just what demographics are worth looking at, as the candidates are doing a lot of micro-targeting in their campaign advertising.
Well, I think, you know, that whole kind of Onion thing is indicative of, you know, it's not about one particular group. It's not just kind of NASCAR dads or soccer moms. These are kind of cute names. I mean, I think this year, you know, you're looking at undecideds. The undecideds in this election are mostly lean a little bit older. A lot of seniors are undecided right now. Maybe we need to be reassured about Obama. You know, a lot of Hillary Clinton supporters are in that kind of undecided kind of swing vote group. So I think that's, you know, the Hillary voters still might be the real swing votes in this election instead of the independents. Those are important, too, but depends on the part of the country, too. Here there are a lot of independents, but out in Florida, it's getting the Hillary people on board for Obama.
So last thing, you also blogged about whether to expect a large bump, the post-convention bump in the polls that candidates often get. Are there reasons to expect or not to expect a large bump for Obama next week?
Well, he didn't get much of a bump out of Biden. The polls have been flat since he named Biden his VP. But the average bump is about 6 points. And I think, you know, I think last night was a good first night for the Democrats. I think we'll really know maybe this weekend. But 6 points is kind of the over-under. My guess is that he'll be right about at 6 points. I think people were persuaded by Michelle Obama last night. I think it's a well-developed, kind of well-organized show. But it'll disappear as soon as it comes because, you know, we have the Republican convention coming immediately next week.
As some of our listeners may know, you are also a big baseball fan. You write for Baseball Prospectus and ESPN. And when we got into town here on the weekend, some of us went to the Rockies-Reds game at Coors Field. And the Rockies are an interesting story. Last year they snuck into the playoffs and they got all the way to the World Series by winning something like 22 out of 23 games at the end, which nobody predicted. This year, they stink. What happened? These are the same players.
I thought you were hoping for a Yankees miracle prediction there that they'd, you know, follow the Rockies'
path.
We're
in Denver now, Nate. I have to take my heart out of it and report where I am.
The Rockies didn't really reinvest in their team last year. I mean, usually when a team kind of reaches a new level of success, they'll, you know, buy some free agents, sign younger players to long-term deals. They just said, well, we're going to bring the same guys back, and you have kind of regression back to the mean, where guys that had career years last year had normal years this year. And so, you know, I mean, you know, the Rockies go 2 or 3 years in a row where they're kind of a 500 club, below 500. You have one kind of lucky year where you play one good month of baseball, basically. You have to invest more and have a more kind of, you know, robust core of talent. So I think they were a little bit kind of overconfident, not really taking advantage of their opportunity heading into this year.
Nate Silver with one hat in the Baseball Prospectus and ESPN universe, the other in the poll aggregation universe. Watching the posters, watch the races at 538.com. You have to spell out the words 538. You can't do it with a number, which gets you to something else. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Jonathan Alter from Newsweek coming up in a minute. Stay tuned. Brian Lehrer on WNYC from the Democratic Convention in Denver. We're going to open up the phones here as we talk to senior editor from Newsweek and Newsweek columnist Jonathan Alter. He's also an analyst at MSNBC. And we can take your phone calls on anything that's going on at the Democratic Convention. And also, Democrats, answer one of these questions that I've been asking the delegates here this week. Can you say what it means to be a Democrat in six words? We know the Republicans can say it in six words. As Chuck Schumer mentioned in his recent book, they can say traditional values, small government, strong defense. If you're a Democrat listening to this coverage of the Democratic Convention, can you say what it means to be a Democrat in six words? Not what you're against, what you're for. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post it to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. But give us a call right now. We've got just a few minutes for this, but we'll put you right on at 212-433-9692. Three words. Six words. What it means to be a Democrat for Jonathan Alter, senior editor and columnist for Newsweek and MSNBC analyst. Hey, Jonathan, how you doing?
How are you, Brian?
I'm okay. You have a post on Newsweek today, The Lessons of Chicago, Reflections on Darker Democratic Days. We were just talking to Bob Henley, who was out supposedly assigned to cover the protests in Denver, and there haven't been many protests. So are there lessons from Chicago 68?
Well, you know, they had this idea called Recreate 68, and I saw some of the demonstration on Sunday, and it was very puny. They expected tens of thousands, and they got about 500, I think. My comparison was not to what happened in the streets of Chicago, but what happened after the 1968 convention when Hubert Humphrey left with a terrible reverse bounce. You know, he slipped far behind Richard Nixon and started to catch up and ended up losing the November election just by a hair. And one of the reasons that he lost was that Gene McCarthy's supporters and Gene McCarthy himself took an awfully long time to come around to Humphrey. Many of them couldn't bring themselves to vote for Humphrey, and as a result, we got Richard Nixon and an awful lot of terrible stuff in American history.
So this is the lesson for Clinton supporters?
I believe it is, yes. I mean, when I saw, you know, an ad yesterday from a self-described Hillary Clinton Democrat explaining why she was for John McCain and looking at these polls that show that there's still quite a sizable number of Clinton supporters who are uncomfortable with Obama and might not vote for him, it reminds me of 1968, and I think that people should think about what the consequences are of that decision.
And really not just 1968. I think you could go through so many elections over the last few decades and see how a strong division within either party during the primary season helped result in a loss in November. How about 1976 when Gerald Ford, as the incumbent, got challenged from the right by Ronald Reagan? Ford lost to Carter. Then 4 years later, in 1980, Carter, as the incumbent, was seen as too conservative and got challenged from the left by Ted Kennedy. And that divided the party. And, of course, Ronald Reagan won in 1980. 92, Pat Buchanan challenged the incumbent George H.W. Bush from the right strongly in the primary, and Bush went on to lose his reelection bid. So this thing seems to happen over and over again and would not seem to bode well for Obama.
Well, it depends on what Hillary Clinton does tonight and what the feeling is coming out of this convention, whether they get what Hillary called catharsis, and so that you can, you know, paper over some of the problems and get most of the folks on board. But it is definitely a problem for Obama. I think the a 1976 comparison is one to look for tonight when Ronald Reagan who lost Gerald Ford that year, lost the nomination to the incumbent president, Gerald Ford, but got a much more rousing welcome from the delegates at the Kansas City Convention. So it'll be interesting to see how long the floor demonstration lasts tonight for Hillary Clinton and how successful the Obama whips on the floor are at shutting it down so that it doesn't overwhelm other receptions that people like Michelle Obama have received.
Now, also tonight, I know you've been reporting on Mark Warner, and he's going to be technically the keynote speaker, not so well known to our listeners in the New York area. Why is Mark Warner the keynote speaker?
The keynoter is usually given to somebody who represents the face of the future of the party. Sometimes somebody like Barack Obama the last time, who is going to get elected to the Senate, and sometimes somebody who might be a prospective presidential candidate or even a prospective vice presidential candidate. Often they flop. So John Glenn flopped in 1976 and didn't go on the ticket as a result. And Evan Bayh flopped in 1996, I guess, or 2000. So Warner is a very, very popular former governor of Virginia who's running for the Senate this year, is expected to win. But the reason they want him in this slot is that he represents what The Onion called, those Dinty Moore dads, people who are NASCAR dads, to use the more conventional term. He did very, very well with them in Virginia. Virginia is obviously an extremely important state for Obama. But nationally, they want Warner's success as a businessman to convey to the country that the Democratic Party is a strong supporter of small business. So you can expect him to talk about some of those themes and about the economy, where he was a successful steward and manager in Virginia as governor. So it's a test of Mark Warner whether he can step up and show that he's ready for prime time if he wants to run in the future, and also whether they can stay on message tonight.
All right. Stay with me, Jonathan, and listen to some of these. You know how the Republicans can say small government, strong defense,
yeah,
traditional values, right?
Right?
They do it all in six words, and the Democrats go, Let's see. We've got a whole board full of Democrats. Let's run through these. This is the Chuck Schumer challenge, because he really challenged the party to be able to do this year and communicate not just what the Democrats are against, but what they're for in a succinct way like that. So let's run through some of our callers and get your reaction to this. Trent? No? Who is it? Kevin in Maplewood. You're on WNYC. Kevin, six words.
Universal health care, economic investment, and environmental protection.
All right. Kevin, thanks a lot. Who can we go to next? Is it Trent in Manhattan? Trent, are you on the air? Oh, Richard in Tarrytown. You're on WNYC. Hi, Richard.
Richard Garfunkel. Yes, I know Jonathan Alter. Equal opportunity, level playing through playing field, and economic fairness. And I
all
wish
right.
Jonathan well, and I hope he to hear him on my radio show. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Now we have Trent in Manhattan. Trent, you're on WNYC. Hi, Trent.
Yeah, hi. Universal medical. No illegal wars, and tax fairness.
All right. Thanks a lot. So there's three, Jonathan Alter.
Yep.
And they seem to be pretty much of a piece. I think Trent kind of summed it up there, right? Universal medical, no illegal wars, and tax fairness. And that was pretty similar to what the other two callers said.
Okay. Those are both good suggestions and themes that are worthy for Democrats to try to advance, but there's some problems with them, and these are problems that Bill Clinton identified when he came up with three words: community, opportunity, responsibility, in 1992 and 1996. The reason they did that, they used those words, was that those are about values rather than programs and positions on issues. And the Republicans have always been more successful at connecting on the level of values, and the Democrats.
That was such a great answer that it deserved a round of applause. Did you? Are you somewhere where there was just a round of applause in the back?
No, I am not.
Oh, okay. I don't know where that came from, or if our listeners even heard it.
Yeah.
But anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
So you know, the Democrats need to get better at communicating their values rather than their specific positions on issues, because there are a lot of issues that Democrats care about, and they're very much in line with issues that the American public cares about, but especially for what are called low-information voters. These are folks who don't vote in primaries but determine general elections. And remember, the difference in the universe is huge. About 36 million voted in the Democratic primaries. About 125 million minimum will vote in a general election, and many of them don't pay attention to politics. So communicating with them, saying universal health care, they don't know what that means. They're busy people. Mm-hmm. They haven't been paying attention to the debate. They don't really care so much whether somebody else is covered with health insurance. They might feel that they're underinsured themselves or that they have some problems in that area, but something like universal health care is not going to win an election.
All right, we're gonna do this through the week, but let's take three more right now real quick. Dallas and Manhattan, you're on WNYC. What are your six words?
My action five words, which was ethical leadership, not moral leadership. And
we don't have time to break it down right now. Let's go next to Sarah in Chicago. You're on WNYC. Hi, Sarah. Sarah, what are your six words?
Progressive values, universal health care, clean environment.
One more. How about that's seven, but we'll let you off the hook. Harriet on the Upper West Side. I think Schumer's number actually was seven. Harriet on the Upper West Side. What are your words?
Caring about people.
Caring about people. That's it. And in a way, that's what we heard, Jonathan Alter, from Michelle Obama last night.
Yes.
Caring about people.
And that's a very important theme for the Democratic Party, and not one to relinquish. It's been a part of the party's appeal for a long time. It conveys a moral core that's important and that strikes a chord with a lot of Americans. If you connect that, though, to some sense of opportunity, so caring and opportunity, then you pull more people into the tent, not just those who care about others, but also those who care about bettering themselves.
Right. And we have to leave it there with Jonathan Alter, senior editor and columnist for Newsweek and analyst with MSNBC. Jonathan, thanks a lot. Always a pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Brian.
And we continue now with our series, Meet the Delegates. I ran into a pair of delegates from California and asked them my usual first question: who are you, where are you from, and what's great about your hometown?
My name is Sherry Holland, and I live in Santa Barbara, California, and it's paradise. It's gorgeous, right on the water, beautiful.
I'm Tim Allison, that's A-L-L-I-S-O-N, also from Santa Barbara, California, an Obama delegate to the Democratic National Convention. Santa Barbara, it's absolutely paradise, and it's a place worth protecting. Barack Obama is a candidate that will do a much better job of that.
Are you also an Obama delegate?
I am, a proud delegate.
What are people talking about issue-wise in Santa Barbara right now?
Definitely offshore drilling is a huge issue and a serious concern to us. And Tim knows a lot more about that than I do, but we are concerned about that, and McCain being very willing to just open it up and start drilling again, and opening, or I guess ending the moratorium or whatever it is. It's just horrifying and very scary for us.
What else? What other issues?
It's a whole range of issues. I think when you take a look at the range of issues, Barack Obama will do a much better job than John McCain on health care, on getting our troops home from Iraq, on protecting the environment, on putting people back to work. John McCain doesn't seem to realize there's an economic crisis in this country, and people are hurting, and people are having a hard time making their mortgage payments and just keeping a job.
What does it mean to you to be a Democrat in 2008?
You know, being a Democrat, for me, is about putting people first. It's about looking after the interests of those hardworking people, the low-income and the middle-income people in this country that are just trying to get by, about putting in place public policy that helps people as opposed to corporations, as opposed to military contractors, And I think we have a wonderful opportunity in this country to turn things around. I'm optimistic about the future of our country, but the reality is the last 8 years have been tough on this country, on our future. I've got a 5-year-old son here at the game with me today, and I worry about what kind of country we're going to leave him.
What does it mean to you to be a Democrat in 2008?
It means excitement. It means I'm thrilled to be here. I'm 41 years old, never been involved in politics before, was only inspired by Senator Obama, actually at his speech 4 years ago at the DNC. I wasn't there. I watched it on TV and knew that there was something, that he had something special. And, for months I've been working, canvassing and calling on his behalf. And, 6 months, 9 months ago, people said, we love him, but he'll never win. He'll never get the nomination. And look where we are today.
So. What do you do for a living?
I'm actually a consultant. I do MBA consulting.
How about you?
I do real estate. Let me also say, since we're talking the NPR affiliate in New York, I've got a lot of good friends in New York. They are they're going through a period. A lot of them were Hillary supporters, and they're trying to kind of sort through their feelings and figure out what to do next. Let me say specifically to those that were Hillary supporters, we have a lot more in common. As an Obama supporter, we have a lot more in common with you than you would with having to put together in the next 4 years the phrase president and John McCain. For me, that's a horrifying thought.
Thanks a lot. Enjoy the convention.
We also remind you that any spectator going onto the field or interrupting play.
And as you might have been able to tell, we recorded that interview with those two delegates outside of Coors Field as the Colorado Rockies game was about to begin. That was on Sunday afternoon. We are awaiting comedian Margaret Cho, who is here in Denver and has been watching the convention and has some observations. Full disclosure, she is an Obama supporter, so we'll say that as we set up. Margaret Cho. And Margaret, hello from Radio Row inside the Pepsi Center. Thanks for coming back on WNYC with us.
Oh, thank you very much. It's very exciting.
So what are you doing in Denver? Are you here for the convention?
I am here for the HRC's Rock to Win concert tonight at the Fillmore Auditorium. I'm here going to be bringing
What's
on
HRC?
Rufus
Does
Wainwright.
That,
uh-huh. Human Rights
that doesn't
Campaign.
Stand for... Oh, human, not human, Hillary Rodham human, Clinton.
No. But it could, because actually they backed Hillary, and now we're we're backing Obama, which is very exciting. And I've been an Obama supporter for a long time, so I'm thrilled to be here and just kind of watching all this. It's very thrilling.
How much convention media have you been consuming?
Yeah. I've just been, watching. I watched the Michelle Obama last night, which I thought was so beautiful and exciting. And I just thought she was great. And I love the moment at the end where her daughters were there and Dad was on the video feed. And it was just a beautiful moment where we could just oh, wow, this is the first night of this very magical kind of story. And
yeah. Some of our callers thought that she was just way too saccharine. They wanted to see the real Michelle.
Hey, she was great. I thought what they were presenting was a new version of Kamala. This is what we need. We need some warm and fuzzy. We've had enough Sturm and Drang over this whole thing. And we need a little bit of family time. I think this is great. I thought she was great.
Any thoughts on the culture of the convention or of the Democrats who get involved?
Well, I think this year it's especially exciting because of Barack Obama and because, we are ushering in a whole new generation to a lifetime of political activism. And so we're seeing a lot more younger people. We're seeing this whole thing as being a lot more rock and roll. It's very, very cool. Could you imagine rock stars making tributes for John Kerry? They weren't doing that in 2004. So now, you have people like Will.i.am and Dave Stewart making these really cool rock videos in support of Obama. It's just amazing. So I'm thrilled about it.
And you obviously have strong feelings as a person who cares about the world. But as a comedian, mm-hmm. are you also watching with an eye out for the absurd?
Well, yeah, you kind of have to. You want to see what's going to happen, and you just want to make sure that you don't miss it. So I'm definitely watching out for that, for sure.
So any fodder for your act yet?
We'll see. I don't know. I just got here, so I have to see what it's like. I haven't been to any parties yet, so that's what I need to do.
There you go. What'd you think of the stage watching Michelle last night? We were thinking it looks like the pulpit area in a mega church, which is probably no accident.
Yeah, it does. It's got a kind of a Joel Osteen kind of feeling to it. Like it's very, but it's modern, kind of like mixing not just this sort of televangelism, but also The Secret a little bit. So it's very modern. You know, it's not so much just like very televangelist.
Now, you've done a lot on gender, and I think we see two very different kind of men. We're going to be talking about this a lot more tomorrow with Susan Faludi, but I'm just curious about your own thought on your way out the door here in our last few seconds. John McCain and Barack Obama are very different kind of men. Do you see masculinity, notions of masculinity on competition here?
Well, I definitely see there are kind of notions of masculinity, like what is more masculine, the family man or the soldier? And I have to say the family man. I mean, that seems to be what Barack Obama is really just presenting at this point, is that he is such a family man, and that is really, really great. We don't need any more soldiers right now. We need to reunite our family.
Margaret Cho in Denver doing some of the music events and other things at the Democratic Convention or outside the Democratic Convention. Thanks a lot for coming on with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We will be back tomorrow with Susan Faludi to talk more about gender roles in the presidential campaign and much more. And follow us on Twitter during these two convention weeks. Just sign up to follow Brian Lehrer on Twitter.com or watch for my updates through the day on the WNYC homepage.